Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader supports single-payer health care, withdrawal from some international trade agreements, and extensive political reform. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and today on Odyssey, we'll talk with a Nader campaign spokesman about issues of concern to Illinois and how the candidate would seek to address them. That's today on Odyssey. Next, after the news, here on WBEZ, Chicago.
News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Israel has closed the Palestinian airport in the Gaza Strip for the second time since violent clashes began escalating this fall. And the Israeli army has also imposed a blockade on a Palestinian town. NPR's Linda Gradstein has more.
An Israeli security source said the airport was closed after armed Palestinian police entered the facility and Israeli security personnel who were examining luggage left because they said they were afraid the police were going to shoot them. But Palestinians said the closure was meant to pressure them to stop the violent clashes. The Palestinian Director General of the airport said the closure will prevent the transfer of wounded Palestinians to hospitals in Arab countries. Israel also imposed a blockade on Beit Jela after Palestinians shot at a Jewish suburb of Jerusalem from there. On Sunday night, Israel responded to the shooting with missiles and tank-mounted machine gun fire. Meanwhile, two young Palestinians who had been injured in previous clashes died today, and dozens were injured in new confrontations. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Secretary of State Madeleine Albright met today with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-il in Pyongyang. Among the issues she raised was U.S. concern with North Korea's missile development program and its export of missile technology to Iran and Syria. Albright's discussions could lay the groundwork for a visit by President Clinton to North Korea later this fall. Strong winds have forced NASA to scrub today's Florida landing attempt for the space shuttle Discovery. It's the second straight day the landing has been canceled because of poor weather conditions. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
The astronauts have enough food and fuel on board to keep orbiting the Earth until Wednesday if they have to. Mission managers are sounding like they'll take any landing spot they can get today, and that means California is the only option. Today's forecast in Florida calls for winds gusting up to 25 knots, with 15 knots being the acceptable limit. The backup landing strip at Edwards Air Force Base in California is bad as well, with a broken cloud deck at 7,000 feet and the threat of showers. The weather will be evaluated hour by hour. The astronauts don't close the shuttle's clamshell payload bay doors until just before 1 p.m. Eastern time. That signals NASA's intent to bring the shuttle down. A decision on whether to keep the crew in orbit another day could be made by then. Discovery is wrapping up a mission to the International Space Station. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
In a ceremony in the White House Rose Garden, President Clinton has signed legislation setting the national drunk driving standard at a 0.08% blood alcohol content level. Mr. Clinton said the tougher standard is projected to save about 500 lives a year. Joining him at the ceremony was Millie Webb, leader of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, whose daughter and nephew were killed in a crash caused by a driver with a 0.08 blood alcohol reading. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 87 points in moderate trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index is up just over 10 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, Wall Street is into its third consecutive positive trading session as investors look at more corporate earnings numbers and the details of an industrial merger. NPR's Dave Mattingly joins us with the latest.
The Dow Jones Industrials and the NASDAQ have been higher for most of the day. The Dow has gotten a strong push from 3M earnings. Third quarter net income rose 8%. That was better than Wall Street expected. 3M credits stronger sales in Asia. Shares of Honeywell International are higher today. This follows General Electric's $45 billion deal to acquire Honeywell International. However, shares of GE are lower. Shares of Lucent Technologies are up slightly after the company ousted chairman and chief executive Richard McGinn. This follows a series of disappointing earnings projections. Lucent's former chairman, Henry Schacht, will return to his old job and help find McGinn's successor. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
The president of the Bridgestone Firestone Corporation says so far the company has found no major problems with the tires that were recalled this summer. Yoshiro Kaizaki says the firm has already replaced or paid for exchanging more than 4 million of the 6.5 million recalled tires. He added that Bridgestone and the Ford Motor Company have different views on whether the tires are entirely responsible for the accidents that prompted the recall. Prices at the pump are on the upswing again. In the past 2 weeks, the average price of gasoline rose nearly 3 cents a gallon in the U.S. Analysts attribute the increase to new concerns about the availability of crude oil following the recent violence in the Middle East. Another downsizing, Stamps.com will cut 240 jobs or 40% of its workforce to reduce costs. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
Good morning and welcome to Odyssey on WBEZ Chicago, 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. There are six candidates for president on the ballot in Illinois, the two major party candidates, obviously, and four others with various party affiliations. Today and tomorrow on Odyssey, we will hear from representatives of the third-party campaigns about where their presidential candidates stand on issues of concern here in Illinois and in the nation as well. Today, we're going to talk with Dan Johnson-Weinberger, who is Illinois State Coordinator for the Nader 2000 campaign. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Gretchen.
Thanks very much for joining me. A representative of Patrick Buchanan's campaign had agreed to join us today as well, but withdrew this morning. So we're just going to talk with Dan. And I want to focus on issues that come up in Illinois elections that seem to be of interest to voters here in Illinois. But let me begin by asking you briefly to talk about why Ralph Nader decided to run.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Ralph decided to run because, consistent with his career, he wants a shift of power from corporations to people, and he wants a fundamental political reform so that regular people have much more influence in decisions that get made.
All right, we'll get back to some of those topics later on, but let's start with what that begin to translate some of that into specifics in our region. I want to start with an issue that is very regional, and we're finding out that local governments are coming up with all sorts of strategies to tackle it, and that has to do with growth, projected growth in the next 20 years. Within the next 20 years, we're expected to have around 9 million people living in the Chicago area, an area that's already quite crowded and you know, has all sorts of traffic and problems related to that sort of growth, and the solutions may lie at a variety of levels. What would Ralph Nader as president have to say about managing growth in a region like ours?
Well, a lot of healthy things in which we feel the citizens of northern Illinois would end up a lot better. The main one is we want to de-emphasize car-centered planning. There's no need to have most of these suburbs built entirely around the car, and there's a bit of a backlash around that in some of the inner ring suburbs, but most of the exurban ring is being built around the automobile. That's a problematic. Ralph Nader wants to put a significant investment in public transit. There's no reason why, with the density we have in northeastern Illinois, we shouldn't have a phenomenal mass transit system instead of a merely adequate one, and that's just a question of money. So if we put more money in our mass transit systems, we could have a much better mass transit, you know, in our trains and Metra, NCTA, and PACE. And with better transit, people start to use it, which means we have less sprawl, less highways, better living for people.
What do you think is the balance? An issue that often comes up in talking about mass transit is striking a balance between encouraging people to use mass transit by making it convenient, making it demand sensitive, you know, putting it in thoughtful, you know, planning it in thoughtful ways, and finding other more coercive ways to encourage people to use coercive is maybe not the right word, but you know, there are ways that involve more compulsion on the part of the government to get people to use public transportation. Can you talk a bit about where you think, or where Ralph Nader might think the balance lies between those two?
Well, I think it's the demand side. I mean, I don't think we should push people into trains, but I mean, you know, the Metra schedule on the weekends is very sparse. You know, it's designed around commuters. The CTA, you know, it's not as clean as some people would like it to be. I think the problem with mass transit is just a question of resources. We're not spending enough money on mass transit. We're spending too much on highways. Under Clinton Gore, they cut all operating subsidies for mass transit, and that's precisely why there was that round of cuts in the CTA in the last 4 years or so. Only now there's beginning to be a slight uptick in providing service for the CTA and for Metra and for PACE. And now that there's a surplus, now they're finally starting to put some money back into capital expenses. But part of the new Democrat plan was specifically to cut money for mass transit. And that had real-world effects here in Chicago, in which there were, bus lines were cut, and, they closed the blue line on weekends, and the purple line doesn't run at night anymore. And that means because there's less money from the federal government for mass transit, there's less public transit for people to use in Chicago. That was a mistake. That's one of the many criticisms that people in the Green Party have of the new Democrats represented by Clinton and Gore, and that's something that we think ought to be reversed.
What about the other side of that equation? Would there be policies in place that would discourage the use of cars, discourage, and what might they be, discourage highway construction?
Well, Nader hasn't, the big thing that would discourage highway construction is not spending so much money on building new highways. The Route 53 extension or, finishing the 355 link around the, metro region. These are things that are not priorities under a Nader administration, which I'm looking forward to in January of 2001. It's ultimately just a question of money and where we spend our public funds. And we've spent too much of it on highway construction and not enough of it on mass transit. I always would think, that it would be something like 50-50 or, there'd be more spent on mass transit because that's better for the environment and better for more people. But in fact, it's not the case. Mass transit gets, 20%, 25% of any federal transit funds, which seems, far too low. And we should be spending more federal funds on mass transit in order to get more transit-oriented development so that everybody doesn't have to have a car to get around. That just makes it more expensive for especially working people to get from job to job. It'd be a lot easier on the on people who are working for a living if they could just take the train or a bus or an L. And one of the main reasons why they can't take a bus or train from the work, from the home to work, is because there just isn't enough federal funds going into mass transit. So I don't think it's a sophisticated or difficult problem to solve. It's just where we put our energy and our resources in the federal government in our transportation policy, and we've made a decision, especially with the new Democrats, to put into highway development, and that's been a problem.
Let's talk about another issue. Let's talk about education. This is an issue that is constantly comes up in campaigns here in Illinois. It comes up a lot in presidential campaigns, despite the fact that, of course, education is overwhelmingly controlled at the state and local level. Mm-hmm. And so that there's always the question of, to what extent the federal government should have a role at all. Can you talk a bit about education policy?
Sure. If the Green Party were running Illinois, we'd certainly be putting in the Edgar Netsch plan to have more funds into lower income areas and using the income tax instead of the property tax. That's sort of, the common sense thing that, of course, we need to do that to provide equal opportunity for all people. But you're right, because a presidential campaign really doesn't deal with most education policy. The big things that Nader has been pushing is trying to de-emphasize this sort of new religion on standardized tests to measure all progress and standards and accountability for students. That's overemphasized, and it's something that a Nader administration, the Department of Education, would try to reverse. The other thing is, of course, it's just a question of resources. Instead of putting more money into corporate welfare or more money into the defense, we should put money into school construction. Carol Mosley Braun has been, she was advocating and was advocating before she left for New Zealand, was that, like we have federal bonds that create a variety of projects that are used for the local and state levels, we should do this for school construction. The federal government should be helping to fund the construction of schools and the maintenance of schools. There's no reason why this isn't a national project, and that's entirely consistent with local control or state control. If it's just a question of money to build the facilities, that should come from the federal government. We shouldn't have crumbling schools,
Why is construction of schools or maintenance of the physical plant of schools an appropriate area for federal involvement in education when others might not be?
It's a fair question, and That's sort of an easy one. It's easy for the federal government to get involved in school construction because there's no question of what standards, what are you teaching our children. What the advocates of local control of schools typically cite is that they want the ability to tell their children what they're going to learn. They set the standards, they set the curriculum, and they don't have as much passion on we set, you know, what kind of bricks we use or what the building looks like or, you know, what sort of heating or ventilation systems we have. So among the fiercest advocates of local control of schools, controlling construction and controlling the facilities, that's not really what fuels their passion. So I think it's a non-controversial aspect of if the federal government should have a role in education, that's something where, you know, there's a much broader consensus on.
When you talked before about de-emphasizing standardized tests, the advocates of standardized testing talk about accountability. They talk about measuring the success of schools in educating children. And clearly there are some schools that don't do a good job of educating students. What sorts of measures would be, do you think appropriate for evaluating how those schools are doing? And what role might the federal government have in being part of establishing accountability measures?
Well, I think the federal government, and this is delving more into my personal thoughts, because Ralph Nader hasn't campaigned as much on the proper role for the federal government in defining accountability for local schools. So I want to be clear that this isn't necessarily what Mr. Nader's advocating for. But I think consistent with the things he has been saying is it's entirely possible to create tests which are not just the same standardized tests and measure the same sort of rote memorization, but create a fuller picture of the student. I think it's also pretty easy to identify those schools which are falling behind, the teachers that aren't nearly as energized, the students that are getting lost. And I think under a Nader administration, we can find those schools that aren't doing the job well and try and put in some more resources, get in better teachers if need be, in order to improve those schools locally.
All right, I'm talking today with Dan Johnson Weinberger, who is Illinois State Coordinator for the Nader 2000 campaign. Today and tomorrow on Odyssey, we'll be talking with representatives of the presidential candidates, the minor party presidential candidates who are on the ballot here in Illinois. There are four candidates other than the Republican and Democratic candidates. And I want to mention again that we did invite a representative of Patrick Buchanan's campaign who had agreed to join us but then declined this morning. So that's why we're talking to Dan. Let's talk a bit about the environment. This is obviously a major concern for the Green Party, but I would ask you to speak both broadly in terms of the way Ralph Nader and the Green Party conceive of environmental policy, but specifically as it applies to issues of concern in our region, issues like air quality, the health of the lake, the Zion nuclear plant, and then dealing with radioactive waste, some of those questions.
Sure. You know, pollution is, with the technology we have, it's ridiculous that we allow corporations to continue to pollute as violently as they do. They're real costs, and people are really hurt by pollution. Something that's primarily affecting Illinois are these coal-powered plants downstate in which, you know, in a big form of corporate welfare, the utilities were allowed not to have to pay to upgrade their scrubbers and their pollution control equipment and continue to spew out all these harmful pollutants from their coal power plants. That means people die in Illinois and people get asthma, and that's, I think the figures were something like 9,000 people die every year because, you know, you put pollutants in the air and it comes down and kids get asthma and people with respiratory problems die. That's because if the political parties, the major political parties, are funded by corporate interests, and a lot of those corporate interests are the utilities, they don't fight against the utilities that are funding their campaign. So instead of saying, if you want to be in business, that's fine, you're just going to have clean energy. You're going to have renewable energy. You can use wind power. You can use a scrubber. You can spend the money in order to not, you know, kill small children with asthma, 6,000 or 9,000 a year. That would make our environment a lot cleaner, and that would be real benefits to people. I mean, you know, there are tons of people, unfortunately, who suffer from the worst. Here in Chicago, we know what poverty looks like, and that's where the incinerators go, and that's where most of the pollutants go. And the problem there is we still allow companies, we give them carte blanche to place their incinerators in the, you know, communities of color and low-income communities, and we feel that part of the reason why that still happens from the major political parties is that these same industries help fund their campaigns and help fund their political parties. And in order to break through that cycle of letting the political parties and the candidates let the industries walk over the most vulnerable among us, is we need to break free of their special interest money. And we need to break free of their sort of, as we see it, their tentacles, which are buying public policies in exchange for campaign contributions. So that's one of the, you know, the Green Party is, you know, the clean Green Party. We don't take any special interest money. And one of the reasons why we don't do that is so we don't have to follow any of the industry's agenda so that we can have a clean environment. You know, pollutants don't just come naturally. They come from companies who would rather avoid the costs of not polluting. You know, there's plenty of ways to have a very healthy economy and a healthy, you know, energy policy that don't involve pollutants that really harm people and cause people to die.
What can you talk a bit about at what level of government these sorts of decisions or regulations need to be made?
Well, I mean, it happens at all of them. The federal government is, you know, the most important. We shouldn't be sending any more corporate welfare to the extractive industries. We shouldn't, oil companies should be having to pay more than they do in taxes. There shouldn't be any accelerated depreciation schemes in which they end up paying less in taxes. We should be taxing pollution much more than we already are. And we certainly shouldn't be encouraging pollution in the form that we are through the corporate welfare to the oil companies and the refineries, to the large extent that we do. We certainly shouldn't be allowing oil companies to merge. We should have much stronger antitrust regulations, or rather antitrust enforcement, to block these proposed utility mergers. And we should be encouraging, through federal funds, renewable energy. You know, they call Minnesota and the Dakotas the Saudi Arabia of wind power because there's all this open space and it's so windy. We should be encouraging, through federal funds and research and development tax credits and taxing pollution that hurts people, we should be encouraging wind energy and solar energy. You know, it's not sort of the Jetsons. It's absolutely possible. The problem is we don't tax bad pollution enough, and we don't provide enough federal funds for the good energy sources. And so the reason why we feel that happens is the Green Party and the Nader campaign is because the companies that are profiting off of energy sources that hurt people, coal primarily, and oil, they fund political campaigns. And if you fund political campaigns, then, you know, you're investing in that particular candidate. You know, and I mean, you know, on the Republican side, they're two Texas oil men. But on the Democratic side, you know, Al Gore's got $500,000 or something like that in Occidental Petroleum stock. And the oil companies, you know, spend a lot of money for the Democratic Party. And so we don't believe that either Al Gore, certainly not Bush and Cheney, are going to stand up to the oil companies and stand up for working people and stand up for people that are being harmed by the real pollutants in the air.
But for leaving aside for a moment the role of industry and corporations in creating environmental policy, there is the possibility this year that the Supreme Court could make some decisions that might curtail, possibly even dramatically, the extent to which the federal government is allowed to, or Congress is allowed to, pass environmental legislation. Much environmental legislation rests on an interpretation of the Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, which it appears some of these of the court thinks is has been construed too expansively. And that might limit the federal government's ability to act quite separately from, or separately from, anyway, corporate involvement. What happens then? What if the court decides that the way the federal government has been regulating the environment is a congressional overreach and that they simply can't do it? What happens?
Well, I think that'd be a bad decision by the Supreme Court. I think that's clearly within the congressional power. I think there's a separate but related issue on the administrative agency's power to promulgate their own regulations. I think that was a bad decision by the D.C. Circuit. I think it was called EPA versus D.C. Clean Air Coalition or something like that. From our perspective, you know, we saw a lot of Clinton appointees going along with that sort of reasoning because we feel that, sure, some of the Clinton appointees have been good on, you know, social liberalism. You know, they've been good on feminism. They've been good on pro-choice jurisprudence. But they've been very pro-business. And we feel that that's sort of that's one more reason why we don't like Supreme Court appointees that come from Clinton and come from New Democrats is that they might be, you know, sort of just like in the Clinton mold and the Al Gore mold. They might, you know, have good socially, you know, moderate to socially liberal policies, but on economic issues are very pro-business. And curtailing congressional power is very pro-business. You know, the goal of the business community, I'm sure, would be to curtail congressional power and administrative agency powers to regulate the economy in order to protect workers and citizens and children with asthma. That'd be a very bad decision. And we hope that Democrats don't go along with that. And the Senate also plays an important role in, you know, of course, nominating and approving Supreme Court nominees. So one of the reasons why we're running is we don't trust Al Gore and we don't trust the Senate Democrats to nominate and approve Supreme Court nominees that will make sure that, you know, the New Deal conception of how, you know, the Commerce Clause stays in effect and that we don't have a backtrack to, you know, pre-New Deal era where congressional power was seen as very limited and they couldn't regulate the economy in order to protect workers and regular people.
The issue of Supreme Court justices has been one that the Gore campaign has talked a bit about in an attempt specifically to lure potential Nader voters back into the Gore fold by saying the stakes in losing this election are that you'll have a Republican president appointing Supreme Court justices, and that is far worse than just having having the Democrat lose the election might not in and of itself be particularly a problem since many Nader voters see little difference between the two, but that is one area where there is a significant difference. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'd point to Al Gore's vote to confirm Antonin Scalia. And I think it's, generally Democrats haven't been the champions of appointing the great Supreme Court justices. And sure, I think some of Bush nominees might not be as good as Gore nominees, might not be. Who knows? That's the beautiful thing about the Supreme Court. A lot of surprises, and if we pick people that are, you know, take judicial independence seriously, they shouldn't be a party label attached to a Supreme Court justice. One of the reasons why I'm not nearly as scared of, you know, turning back the clock and overruling precedents is that's one of the things that bind the Supreme Court together. I don't think it'd be constitutional or legal right now, as best interpreted, for the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade because precedent matters to the Supreme Court. And it was indicative of that to see Chief Justice Rehnquist reading the opinion to uphold Miranda. And there was a lot of fear, you know, that, well, Miranda's only, what, 25 or maybe 30 years old, and that's the liberal Warren Court, and now the conservative Rehnquist Court is going to overturn it. But they found that precedent mattered. And I think Roe v. Wade is just as fundamental to what it means to American law now as Miranda. It's the Miranda warnings. So it's almost inconceivable to me that they would overturn Roe v. Wade. I understand that.
But it's not impossible.
Well, it's not impossible, and it's a very effective Democratic scare tactic. But I think, you know, if you want to look at it from a partisan perspective, I think it would destroy the Republican Party. A clear majority of Americans are pro-choice. And if you'd imagine Supreme Court justices as sort of, you know, partisan hacks just looking to implement their partisan agenda, I think it would be a bad decision on the Republican Party's part. And I can imagine that happening. Plus, you know, there's the U.S. Senate. And the U.S. Senate plays a very important role. And, you know, nominees get blocked all the time. And if, you know, anybody thinks that, you know, every time Al Gore says, you know, George Bush is going to appoint another Antonin Scalia, well, ask him why he voted to confirm Antonin Scalia. If he's such a monster, you know, the man voted to confirm him. I'm sure if a caller knows otherwise, they'll call and let me know. But I believe that Lieberman was one of the Democrats who crossed over to vote for Thomas. I'm not confirmed on that one, but that's one of the rumors floating around our camp. But it's certain that Al Gore and Joe Lieberman, come to think of it, he was in the Senate. They all voted to confirm Scalia. It was unanimous. So if that's the boogeyman, you know, the Democrats are just as guilty as the Republican president who nominated him.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll also take some phone calls. I'm talking today with Dan Johnson Weinberger, who is Illinois State Coordinator for the Nader 2000 campaign. And I'd like to mention again that we did invite a spokesperson for the Pat Buchanan campaign, and they originally agreed to join us and then declined. So we'll come back. We'll talk about trade when we come back and take some calls at 312-832-3124, 832-3124. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago.
WBEZ is the radio sponsor for the Dance Center of Columbia College. Choreographer David Dorfman and his company will join community members to present The Move Project, October 26th through the 28th. His new work was inspired by the Dance Center's relocation to its new South Loop home at 1306 South Michigan Avenue. Ticket information at 312-344-8300. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by the Jewish Federation of Metropolitan Chicago, providing support, food, and medical care to people in Israel and other countries. Jewish Federation, beginning a second century. The faces change, the need remains.
On the next Fresh Air, Tim Meadows. His new film, The Ladies' Man, is based on a character he created for Saturday Night Live. Also, a modern-day whale hunt, complete with tribal hunters, protesters, and media from around the world. We talk with author Robert Sullivan. I'm Jerry Gross. Join us.
Don't miss Fresh Air weekdays at 2 o'clock right here on WBEZ. That's this afternoon at 2 here on WBEZ Chicago, 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio.
You're listening to Odyssey on Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Today on the program, we're talking with Dan Johnson Weinberger, who is Illinois State Coordinator for the NADER 2000 campaign. Today and tomorrow, we're talking with representatives of the presidential candidates on the ballot in Illinois, not from the major parties. We'll take some calls in a few minutes, 312-832-3124, 312-832-3124. Before we go to calls, I would like to talk about the issue of trade. Chicago is a trading city, and Ralph Nader proposes withdrawing from several major trade agreements. Could you talk a bit about that?
Absolutely. The current international trade agreements are one of the clearest examples of the corporate sellout of the Democratic Party, especially under Clinton, who put all of his political capital into these free trade agreements and not nearly enough into universal health care from the green perspective. The problem is not trade in and of itself. The trade within the United States between Illinois and Indiana, that's a great example of trade because we have strong environmental laws, strong labor laws. The problem when we trade with Indonesia or China now, in which we'll start doing that, is that China does not share those same environmental laws and they don't share the same labor laws. The World Trade Organization and the North American Free Trade Agreement are both designed the same way. The overriding purpose of the trade agreements is to lower tariffs without simultaneously raising protections for workers and consumers. It's now illegal for the United States to ban products made by slave labor. It's illegal for us to say you can't sell any products that are made for child labor. That's no longer something that's within the sovereignty of the United States under the World Trade Organization, under the World Trade Agreement. We can try that, but then we're subject to sanctions, and we'll have to pay for the privilege of asserting our fundamental right as a nation to decide that slave labor has no place in the United States. That is fundamentally in the corporate interest, that slave labor is great for profits. And unfortunately, there's still slavery in the country, in the world, rather. And there's plenty of child labor. And if that's something that we find morally reprehensible and unacceptable, there's no longer anything we can really do about it in the United States under the World Trade Organization. These decisions, then, as to what is considered an unfair restraint of trade and what's, you know, within the sovereignty of a country to do, these decisions, they don't get made by any elected officials, any elected bodies, any judges that are open to the public. Instead, they're made in secret in Geneva by arbitrators who are chosen by the parties, you know, the country and the company that's suing the company under NAFTA and under the WTO, under the countries get to choose them. There's no record. It's not transparent. You can't appeal. So if you'd like to try and influence the decision of the World Trade Organization, you know, too bad. There's no press is not invited. The public's not invited. And as the Global Exchange folks like to say, you know, this is a slow-moving coup d'etat, in which there's a secret organization, inaccessible from the public, inaccessible from, you know, non-governmental organizations. You can't submit an amicus brief. You can't read the, you know, it's not like the Supreme Court where you get to read the decision and understand the jurisprudence and try to influence it. The edict is handed down, and that's the end of the story. You know, it's fundamentally undemocratic, and that's not the way we ought to run the world. But that's the way the World Trade Organization runs. So we should withdraw from NAFTA, withdraw from the WTO, and set up trading agreements which respect human rights, respect the environment, have some sort of a minimum wage for everybody, not just people in, you know, the Western world, so that we can have trade that's fair trade, not just free trade. There's a reason why we're, you know, losing most of our manufacturing jobs. There's a reason why there's immense downward pressure on wages in Northern Illinois. And that's because now, thanks to Clinton and the new Democrats and, of course, the Republicans, you know, we're competing with wages people in China.
So do you, is it the position of the of Ralph Nader and of the Green Party that in where countries will not agree to environmental and labor standards and minimum wages that there should be no trade?
It's a fair, nuanced question. It's certainly the position of the Green Party and the Nader campaign that we should use our right with 6 months' notice to withdraw from the World Trade Organization. We have that right to do so, and NAFTA. And we should renegotiate these trade agreements. And there should be trade agreements. We should be trading as much as we can. But we should be trading fairly with other countries so that instead of pushing our standards down and pushing our wages down and our environmental protections down, we should be lifting their environmental protections and their wages up.
Let me ask you this, though. Why should we be trading? Different people have different beliefs about why we should trade.
Well, there's, I mean, the happy story is I think there's something to the fact that nations that trade with each other tend not to go to war together. I think the more we bind, you know, the world together, the better off we are. And it's a good thing, and it makes war less likely. People disagree with that, but I think that's sort of the good story. But then there's something too, you know, the economists say that that trade in general is a good thing. If Illinois is better at creating steel and Detroit's better at creating cars and, you know, China's better at creating rice and we're better at creating grain, then China shouldn't get in the business of creating grain. You know, they should buy ours and then we should buy their rice. So there's something to comparative advantage. And so trade in general is a nice thing and a good thing for the economy. If both parties are better off by trading, you know, then it's a win-win. Where it gets to be problematic is when we get on the side of the oligarchs and the dictators and the corporations that, you know, play one country off of each other, always driving wages down, always driving regulations down, and then, much like many companies do in the U.S., and play a state against each other to try to get more corporate welfare in the form of tax breaks. You know, we'll put our Motorola plant here, or we'll put our GM plant there if you give us more money. Much like they do that in the U.S., playing a state against each other in order to try and get more and more corporate welfare. You know, the companies are now doing that country to country and saying, we'll build our plant here if you don't tax us for 10 years or if you make sure no unions around here. You know, we want to make sure that there are no environmental protections and you'll look the other way. And it's a race to the bottom. You know, you see in the U.S. when they, you know, the companies that come in with 100 jobs end up paying no taxes at all. You know, the worst example perhaps is the New York Stock Exchange, which cut a deal with New York City in which they won't pay taxes. You know, they're doing this in the third world, in the developing world, in which they're playing one country against each other, against another, not to pay any taxes, not to have environmental protections. It's a real problem. And that is the dynamic of the World Trade Organization and NAFTA and the push for free trade, which both major party candidates, backed by corporate money, are aggressively pushing.
All right, let's take some phone calls. Our number is 312-832-3124. There are a lot of other issues we could talk about, so we'll let the callers bring up a few things. 312-832-3124. Let's talk with Kelly. Good morning, Kelly. You're on WBEZ.
Hi. Well, this question is for Dan, and I'm calling on behalf of, I think, a lot of young people without health insurance. I wanted to know what Ralph thinks about national health care and how it will make my life better.
Well, thank you.
Go ahead.
Thanks. That's an excellent question. We're one of the only Western countries, affluent countries in the world, in which many people don't have health insurance. Most countries, notably Canada, but most of Western Europe, has universal health care, which means everybody has health insurance. Just like everybody has a right to see a lawyer if they get in trouble criminally in this country, we should have the right that everybody gets to see a doctor and has health insurance no matter what. You know, it's a real problem when the current figure is 45 million Americans don't have health care. And what that means is, you know, they're living one accident away from bankruptcy. And it's a real disaster. Many people, you know, they get out of college, they're just working, or they're between jobs, or they're working class, or they've got, you know, holding two part-time jobs down, and they just don't have the right to see a doctor. And if they break a leg in an accident, they're wiped out financially. You know, that's ridiculous. Under Clinton, the last 8 years of Clinton, you would imagine that since he campaigned so hard on universal health care. Well, of course, after 8 years of, you know, Clinton, fewer people would be without health insurance when he's done than when he started. But in fact, the opposite is true. 10 million more people don't have health insurance after 8 years of Clinton Gore. And, you know, you have to think that that figure is going to increase. The way to solve this is, you know, what Cure Locally, Quinn Young's been advocating for a long time, single-payer universal health care. We won't have to deal with all the middlemen, with the insurance companies and the marketing. No more television commercials telling you to go to this particular hospital and buy this particular drug. We'd save billions and billions of dollars. From using the same amount of money now that we spend on health care, we could have health care for everybody if we just use a single-payer health care plan. It won't take all this new money. Instead of all the money going to the profits of the insurance companies or the immense profits of the pharmaceutical companies, we can put that into health care for American people. And so everybody can have health care. It's something, it's the unfinished business of the Great Society, and it's high time that finally we got universal health care. And by the way, you know, you don't hear Al Gore, the Democratic Party, calling for universal health care anymore. It's another critique of the new Democrats. Ever since Truman, every Democratic convention has called for universal health care. But that's gone now. In the 2000 Democratic Party platform, universal health care is not there. They talk about our step-by-step, and we'll start with kids. But what that means in political speak is don't worry, HMOs, you know, We're not gonna push you too far. You don't need to worry about anything.
Well, how do you get from, you say that by spending the same amount we're spending now, but you're talking about having the government paying for it. So how, what mechanism would you use? What sort of a tax or a fee or whatever would you use to get that money to the government so the government can spend it?
Well, there are two things. One is we're spending a lot of government money now on what we conceive of as private health insurance, because when a company provides health care to their employees, that's then a business expense, which is tax deductible. So they don't pay taxes on that. That's what they call a tax expenditure. In other words, if we didn't say, hey, you know, GM or Aetna or whatever, all the money that you're spending on your private health insurance plan, you don't need to pay taxes on that money. Without that policy in place, which we have now, we'd be bringing in billions and billions into the federal treasury. So in effect, that's a federal subsidy of private health insurance, because you don't have to pay taxes on the money spent on private health insurance if you're a corporation. That's not the case if you're an individual, but that is a case if you're big. It is a case if you're a big corporation, which is one of the reasons why, you know, we see it as another form of corporate welfare. All those billions of dollars, which we're now spending in the form of a tax expenditure, monies we would otherwise receive to the federal government, but for the tax loophole, which says you don't need to pay taxes on any money that the corporation spends on a private health insurance plan. With all those billions of dollars, that can help us get to what I think is the most the easiest plan, is just Medicare for all. You know, we basically have universal health care if you're over 65. You know, it's not, you know, crazy Canadian plan. It's just Medicare. You know, we've got, you know, Medicaid is basically universal health care if you're poor. But if you're working poor or you're middle class or you're, you know, just out of college and between jobs, we don't have health care for you. And that's a problem. So we should just have Medicare for everybody. And with all those billions of dollars which are going, and of course, we should have price controls on drugs and pharmaceuticals. Many of these drugs, most of them, 95-90% of them, the money that's used to for research and development of these companies comes from the National Institute of Health. They're government funding that develops most of these drugs. And then to turn around and give the rights to these drugs to a private company who makes billions off of them, charges exorbitant fees, and we still don't have price controls, you know, that's outrageous. Nader talks about in his speeches, like he did at the Super Rally in Chicago, October 10th at the Pavilion, in which 10,000 people came, the biggest crowd of any presidential candidate in Chicago. He talked about a woman who needed a particular drug, told that, you know, you needed three of these a week, and the cost for a 14-week period was $60,000. You know, she didn't have that money. So it's, we're at, I mean, they're life and death decisions when you talk about health care. And the decisions that we've made are, we'll let the pharmaceutical companies charge as much as they possibly can, and if people die, well, that's too bad. We're not going to put in price controls. Well, we should, because we spend the federal funds in order to develop these drugs, and the least we can do is make them affordable for people to use them and stay healthy.
All right, Kelly, thanks for your call. Let's take some more calls at 312-832-3124. Let's talk with Steve. Good morning, Steve. You're on WBEZ.
Yeah, hi, Dan.
Hi, Steve.
I'm really behind Ralph 100%. I've, like, taken off of work and everything. But, you know, I heard something today, and I want to know, what is Ralph's position on women's rights and the reversal of Roe versus Wade? That's going to hinge on where I go.
Ralph is 100% pro-choice. He, you know, to the extent that a president can determine what sort of vote Supreme Court justices would make, which is tenuous at best, Ralph would vote to uphold Roe v. Wade, and his justices would too. He's, against parental notification, as pro-choice as you could possibly be.
All right, Steve, thanks very much for your call. 312-832-3124. Let's talk with Rachel. Good morning, Rachel. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Hi, how you doing? Dan, I saw you on the news. I think you're doing great stuff for Ralph Nader.
Oh, that's kind. Thank you.
Anyhow, I heard that there were over 2,000 people in St. Louis protesting the fact that Ralph Nader was locked out of the presidential debate. Why did this happen, and is there anything that can be done about it?
Thank you, Rachel. That's another affront to our democracy that we had a presidential debate in which the Democrats and Republicans conspired together to lock out independent voices, especially Ralph Nader. And who that ripped off were the American voters. It makes me angry to think of the arrogance of the major parties that they're going to control who the voters can listen to in a presidential debate. They set up this front group, the Commission on Presidential Debates, with the explicit purpose of locking out third parties. And you and I didn't get the chance to hear Al Gore or George Bush try to defend their record on free trade, try to defend their support of the death penalty, which both of them are for, try to defend their support of corporate welfare, try to defend their support of a national missile defense system, which won't work, and try to defend their support for dramatically more money for defense, and not their support for universal health care, not their support for renewable energy. This is because they locked out Ralph Nader. And here in Illinois, we had a caravan down to St. Louis take back our debates. We went from Chicago and went through all the downstate towns. We converged in St. Louis, and there were 2,000 of us, including Ralph Nader, demanding entrance into the debates. And they threatened Ralph Nader with arrest. He had a press pass, and he was going to interviews. And the police in St. Louis wouldn't let him into the press room, just like in Boston, because the commission wouldn't allow him in the area. That's a real affront to our democracy that they are affirmatively suppressing alternative voices. And there's a reason why, only 40 million people instead of 90 million people watch the debates. You know, they're boring because alternative voices aren't heard. And Bush and Gore agree on more than they disagree. So we're trying as hard as we can, but it's difficult when the two parties arrogantly are conspiring together to actively suppress third-party voices, and the media doesn't do as good a job as it should at reporting just how bad this is.
What criteria do you think should be used to determine who participates in a presidential debate?
Just like the United Nations treaties on the subject, anybody who's on enough ballots that could win the presidential election should be allowed to debate and let the voters decide who they're going to throw their support to. You know, in Mexico, they had a presidential election over the summer. And there were two main candidates, but there were six people running. And in Mexico, they said, well, of course, when we have our debates, all six candidates will participate. And Fox One, you know, upended the PRI. They said they couldn't be done. But in the Republican primaries, all six or seven or eight people debated. Alan Keyes, he was debating all the way till, you know, almost the convention. You know, when did it become the province of the major parties to decide that third parties and independents, supported by millions of people, clearly, you know, a majority of people in the country would like to hear Ralph Nader in the debates, and Pat Buchanan should have been in the debates, too. And as far as I'm personally concerned, I think Hagelin and Brown should have been in the debates, too. Anybody who's on enough ballots to win this election, they deserve to be in the debates. And it's up to the voters to decide who they're going to vote for. It's not up to the parties to decide whose voices are allowed to be heard in a presidential debate. And it's just an affront to the American voter that the two parties are so arrogant that they're going to lock out alternative voices.
All right, Rachel, thanks very much for your call. 312-832-3124. Let's talk with Mo. Good morning, Mo. You're on WBEZ.
Good morning, Gretchen. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Mo.
My question is not for you, Dan. It's for the Gore voters who are in the dilemma. They really like Nader better, though there are many of them that do, and they're afraid of being spoilers or wasting their vote. And here's my question for them. Were the free soil candidates who opposed the Whig and Democratic Party candidates for president in the 1840s and the 1850s spoilers, or did they pave the way for Abraham Lincoln? Was the Populist Party, were they spoilers, and the progressives, or did they pave the way for the New Deal? Was Henry Wallace a spoiler, or did he force Truman to desegregate the armed forces and come out indeed for universal medical care? The question facing us in all these areas, like corporate takeover, pollution, and environmental disaster, is what will happen if the Democrats succeed in electing these new Democrats like Gore. Will these problems be solved, or will they continue to get worse as they have been in the past? So a vote for Nader, would a vote for him, I'll keep it in the form of a question, would a vote for Nader really be a vote for the future and not a wasted vote?
But, all right. Go ahead, Dan.
I think you're absolutely right, Mo. I think if there's somebody that you agree with and you don't vote for them, you know, then you're wasting your vote. And if you vote for somebody you disagree with, then you're really wasting your vote. But this, I just put an appendix on the message to the Democrats who might be scared of Nader spoiling the election. The reason why there's even talk of a spoiled election is because you don't need to get a majority to win this election. It's ridiculous that, you know, if George Bush gets 45% of the vote and Gore gets 40 and Nader gets 15, that Bush wins, even though a majority of people would probably prefer Nader or Gore to Bush. All we need to do, and this is a message to Democrats with any influence on, you know, how we conduct elections in the state, we should just have a runoff election. And you should require the winner to get a majority support in order to win. And if you have a majority requirement, like most countries do, then all you need to do is, you know, the Nader can run and we can get 15 or 20 or 25% of the vote. And the fear isn't, and we won't have the fear that the candidate that is to the one we least agree with could end up winning with a minority of votes just by using a runoff election. All we need to do is require the winner to get a majority, and then the Gore-Nader majority cannot split between two candidates and let the third candidate, Bush, win with only a minority of votes. So if I were a tactical, savvy Democrat with some influence, I would be sure to implement a runoff election for every conceivable race we have in this state and around the country, because the Green Party is not going away. And as long as the new Democrats and the corporate Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party retains its influence and runs the Democratic Party, and the good people in the Democratic Party are sort of second fiddle, the Green Party is only going to grow, because we need to have an alternative, a progressive alternative for people that don't want to sell out to the corporations to have a place to go. And, it's happened in New Mexico, it's happening in Vermont, and it's only going to continue until the Democrats realize all we need to do is have a majority requirement, have a runoff election, and you could solve the so-called spoiler issue.
Would that require amendments to state constitutions and even possibly the federal constitution?
Not the federal constitution. Certainly, it's very conceivable for the state constitution. But for things like governor, you know, it's possible you can do that with legislation. Even better, if you're scared of a runoff, we have one 3 weeks later, you can do what they do in Australia and Ireland. Just have an instant runoff where you indicate if your candidate is the one who gets eliminated because they don't survive to the runoff round, then who does your runoff vote go to? You put a little two next to the name. You know, that's why they call it the instant runoff. So you can solve the spoiler problem immediately. This is how they elected the mayor of London. And it's one of the main things that the Green Party is campaigning on, is we need proportional representation. We need the instant runoff. We need same-day voter registration. We need a more inclusive, vibrant, participatory democracy. And one of the main reasons why we don't have one is because of our very old, stupid voting system, where you can win with only a minority of votes, you can't register on election day, and a political minority that gets 20% of the vote doesn't get any representation at all. So we should, you know, bring back cumulative voting in the Illinois House, and we should bring back representation for political minorities. We should use the instant runoff. We should use same-day voter registration, so we never have to hear the old tired argument about a spoiled election.
All right, Mo, thanks very much for your call. 312-832-3124. Let's talk to George. Good morning, George. You're on WBEZ.
Hi, I had a question. I was listening to what you were saying about universal health care and so forth. My question is this. You got a system that works for the vast majority of people in the United States. Why do you want to change that system into something that seems very much like a government monopoly? For example, when I go to get my driver's license, I'm not happy with the level of service, and it seems like that's the path you want to go to with universal health care.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair question. If you think Medicare is, providing bad service, you can still choose your own provider in Medicare. It's just paid for. I don't think the system is working now. I think if you have a system where 45 million Americans don't have health insurance, I don't think you can say that system is working. If you've got a good job with benefits, then things might be okay for you. But, you know, I can't agree with you to say that this system is working when 45 million Americans don't have health insurance. And if you get in trouble, that doesn't count the underinsured. And if you get in trouble, you pay these exorbitant fees for pharmaceuticals. You know, if you're wealthy in this country, you've got a great health care system. But if you're working, if you're struggling, if you're middle class, and God forbid if you're poor, we don't have a system that's working. I don't think, you know, to the extent that Medicare works well, and I think that it does, having Medicare for all, I don't think is a crazy radical idea. I think it's common sense. It's going to make more people healthier and give everybody health care. So that's my answer to your fair question.
All right, George, thanks for your call. 312-832-3124. Let's talk with Hillary. Good morning, Hillary. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My caveat, or what I'd like to say before I ask my question, is that I'm very much for the work that Ralph Nader is doing, and the idea that even if, you know, there's a spoiler election, that it does, you know, it definitely moves the whole progress of, you know, change forward with having more than just this two-party monopoly. But my question is that, you know, returning to something you spoke about earlier, Dan, was that you talk about how Ralph Nader has these concerns about the environment and wanting to make things be cleaner, but that there's this problem with an interest and a preferential treatment of big business, which I understand. But then you also talk about protecting, like, the workers. But what about the people who work in those industries that are just regular, you know, folks out there working who are in coal, like in downstate or other parts of the country as well, who will be certainly injured if their businesses are, you know, brought to a greatly diminished state? You know, what kind of assistance might there be to help, you know, make a change for them if they've been working in coal their whole lives? You know, what are they going to do?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I definitely think we can still burn coal in this state. We just need to have the pollution control equipment, which, let me back up. In Illinois, when the Clean Air Act was passed, the coal power plants were grandfathered in, which means they didn't have to comply with the new Clean Air Act requirements. For the last 25 years, they've been allowed to pollute at will. It's entirely, all we need to do is put these coal power plants under the same regulations as every other new power plant in the country. And then the companies just have to cough up and come up with the pollution control equipment so that people don't end up getting hurt from this pollution. You know, workers definitely should have some assistance in getting retrained and brought into, you know, a new job if need be. But for the people that are still, you know, using coal, it's entirely possible to have clean energy, you know, a lack of pollution or greatly diminished pollution from burning coal as long as you have the proper pollution control equipment. And that's just a question of whether the company's going to spend the money or not. And so far, we haven't forced those companies to spend the money.
All right, thanks very much for your call. I guess we don't have time for any more calls. We're going to have to wrap up there. Dan Johnson-Weinberger is Illinois State Coordinator for the Nader 2000 campaign. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Gretchen.
And I would also remind listeners again that we did invite representatives from Pat Buchanan's campaign to join in our conversation today, and they declined. Tomorrow on the program, we'll hear more from other voices on the ballot. We'll hear from representatives of John Hagelin's campaign. He is on the ballot as a Reform Party candidate in Illinois, but he's also associated with the Natural Law Party, and a spokesperson for the Libertarian Party. Their candidate on the ballot in Illinois is Harry Brown. So, more third-party voices tomorrow. Thanks to Steve Warnauskas and Veronica Williams for engineering. Thanks to everyone who called. My apologies to those whose calls we couldn't get to. Thanks to Joshua Andrews for producing and directing. Thanks to everyone who called and pledged during our fundraiser last week. Thanks very much for helping us reach our very large goal. Worldview with Jerome McDonnell is up next. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago.